Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. This is Allison Rosvivi. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and the total health environment. For many years, I've been a reporter on health, food, and the environment, and what we know is we've learned a lot of things about how to take care of personal health and not enough about preserving and protecting our health context, the health upon which we base our lives, the lives of our children and future generations, and the environment from which all our food, water, air, and everything we subsist on and need for life, without which we'd be gone in a few seconds. We focus on the personal and we forget all too often the collective sources of health that support our lives here on Earth. So every week on Connect the Dots, we focus on the collective impacts and environment for health. And each week we talk with different experts, authors, physicians, advocates, who help us protect, promote, and defend health and life on Earth. This week we have a very incredible show with one of my very favorite guests who's returning now for the third time. I usually begin the show with an action opportunity, but this week you guys are getting off the hook because I want to devote our full time to our guest, but I just want to highlight one quick thing, which is instead of taking action this week, although, you know, there are many sources of action, which I hope you all will be taking independently of this, I want to celebrate the 4 years of activist work on the part of the New York State and Northeastern Region anti-fracking community, which has brought about a time that the New York State Assembly has passed a two-year moratorium on fracking, with the State Assembly Speaker of the House, Sheldon Silver, saying, "We will not sit idly by and endanger the health and safety of our communities by rushing necessary health and safety reviews." Our message is getting through, folks. It's, you know, the importance of health and taking that into account when we choose to use various energy forms that carry high risks both in our time and ongoing into the future is no longer something that can be ignored because of powerful industries. And that couldn't be more relevant today than today when I'm having a conversation with one of the leaders in this internationally over decades, a real pioneer in raising awareness. She's physician, Dr. Helen Caldicott. This is her third appearance on this program, and she's been a leader in the anti-nuclear movement and really in all the movements that call attention to the health and medical consequences of energy production forms that risk our health while supplying, you know, our machines and other things. So I just want to welcome you again to Connect the Dots, Dr. Caldicott.
Much.
We're speaking today, and the show will be aired a few weeks past a conference that you're going to be holding, which as we record, it's in a few days. I'll be in attendance. I highlighted it on the show this week, but actually this interview will air following that event. But I'm assuming that there will be live streams and a lot of other information on your website, Nuclear Free Planet, and I have a sense that you probably can give us some highlights of the kinds of discussions that will be happening at your conference on the medical and ecological consequences of the Fukushima nuclear accident. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that with you today, if we may.
Yes.
And people can go to the live stream and other things that I'm sure you'll be posting in the aftermath to get more information.
Yeah.
You know, even the title, The Medical and Ecological Consequences, this symposium was slated on the actual anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear accident, and this is the first time, apart from in your work and on your website, where I've even heard mention anywhere in the media
Of what?
Physical and ecological consequences.
Oh, my God. Well, actually, that's the reason I set this up, because I've been terribly dismayed as a pediatrician and a physician about the level of ignorance that the media has displayed about radiation biology. For instance, George Monbiot, who writes for The Guardian, said, well, nobody's died yet. He and I had an argument on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman moderating just after the accident. And he had the gall to say that because of Fukushima, he has now become pro-nuclear. I couldn't understand that logic at all. But he also didn't understand how long it takes to get cancer. He said no one's dead. Well, the only way you can die of radiation sickness is like that guy Litvinenko died, who got poisoned by some polonium taking tea in Claridge's in Britain, in London. He died within 2 weeks. So in other words, if you get a massive dose of radiation, either taking radioactive substances inside your body by drinking tea that is contaminated, or by being exposed to nuclear weapons, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, what happens is the dose is so high that the actively dividing cells of the body die. Hair, so your hair falls out, you become bald. The gut cells die because they're always dividing, and so you get terrible nausea and terrible bloody diarrhea. And then the blood cells die, specifically the platelets that cause clotting, so you start bleeding. And the white blood cells die, so you can't fight infection, so you die of massive hemorrhage and infection within 2 weeks after you've been exposed. Now, obviously, people didn't get such a high dose, although, very interestingly, there was a U.S. ship called USS Reagan very near Fukushima, and in the first few days, the very, very high levels of radiation blew east across the Pacific, not over Japan, but over the Pacific, and they were close in just east of the reactor, and they got high doses, and about 150 of the sailors are saying that they developed bald patches and they were bleeding and they got infections and the like, and they had diarrhea. They may have had quite a high dose. But the truth is that medically, after people have been irradiated by either external radiation, like X-rays or gamma rays coming from radioactive materials in the reactors, or by eating radioactive food, contaminated food containing cesium or strontium or plutonium or whatever, and those elements go inside the body and concentrate in various organs like the thyroid, causing thyroid cancer, liver, lung, and the like. After you've been irradiated, what happens is that radiation damages genes, cause mutations, and there's a gene in every cell that controls the rate of cell division called the regulatory gene, and when that has been mutated or damaged, the cell will sit silently any time from 5 to 80 years, and then one day, instead of dividing in a regulated fashion by mitosis into two daughter cells, it starts dividing uncontrollably and produces trillions of cells, and that's a cancer. So it takes a single mutation in a single cell, I'm being simplistic here, to induce cancer. Furthermore, the cancer doesn't identify its origin. It doesn't say, look, I was made by some cesium-137U8 in a fish caught on the West Coast, 15 years after Fukushima, that contains cesium. Because a lot of huge amounts of radiation have been poured into the Pacific Ocean from that damaged reactor, and that's still happening. So a cancer doesn't identify its origin. A cancer takes many years to manifest itself. But we do know that radiation is a very potent stimulator of cancer. And the journalists didn't seem to understand that at all. So that's why I set up the symposium, to deal with that and very many other related medical topics related to radiation in Fukushima.
That's terrific. So that's kind of, how it works. One journalist's ignorance, and we all get to benefit. What you know, I think most people listening to this program, for example, although the show is international, probably the preponderance of our audience is in the U.S. And so, you know, I think I was shocked at the time we first had you on Connect the Dots after Fukushima, and I was frankly shocked at the American coverage at the time. And since then, it's kind of dropped off the charts a bit, and it's kind of like, well, this is a problem over in Japan, and poor them, you know, there couldn't be any medical consequences anywhere else. So, you know, I would love, I think it's important to do two things, you know, to kind of get your views on two different questions here, and in either order. You know, one is, I think it's important for people to know, because we have nuclear reactors all over the United States, what it looks like for the region in terms of the health and ecological impacts when this happens. And, of course, 2 years down the line, there should be more sense of that in Japan. But also because we, you know, are here on Earth and everything travels on winds and different things happen. Food, you know, is imported, exported, winds travel and you know, go into the food supply. There could be more distant effects as well. I don't know how well those are being monitored. But, you know, can you give us a picture of what the near and far effects, you know, what they are and what the differences are?
Okay, so in the Fukushima prefecture, which is like a state, they have now done ultrasound examinations on children under the age of 18, and they've looked at over 100,000 children, and more than 40% of them are demonstrating either cysts, little holes in the thyroid filled with fluid, or nodules, solid tumors. Now, this is unusual in a pediatric population. I mean, I've never seen a cyst or a nodule in any of my patients, nor have I read about it in the literature. But also, some of these patients are going to go on to develop thyroid cancer, and indeed three already have. Seven more are suspected. Now, this is extremely unusual. A, because it took 5 years for thyroid cancers to start appearing post-Chernobyl in that affected population. And B, because this is very early. And it would indicate that these children had a very high dose of radioactive iodine to their thyroid glands, and also cesium, which concentrates also in the thyroid gland. And that is a very foreboding issue, because it means they also inhaled or ingested very large amounts of other isotopes which go to the lung and the liver and the fetus and the bones. And so all cancers that have been described in the medical literature can be caused by radiation. So these people and others who have been exposed are at great risk. The Japanese government is not following these people up adequately at all. There is active suppression of the data about the thyroid cancer in Japan. People are being encouraged to eat radioactive food grown in Fukushima, which will be good for the farmers in Fukushima. Much of the food in Japan now is contaminated. Even green tea grown to the south of Tokyo has cesium-137 in it, which causes brain cancers, muscle cancers, and other cancers. And cesium lasts for 600 years. So what happens is when these isotopes or elements land on the soil, the roots of the vegetables and the grass and the trees suck them up and concentrate them in the fruit, in the vegetables. And then, of course, the cows eat this, and the elements are concentrated further in the milk and the meat. And then we stand at the apex of the food chain, and these elements are concentrated most highly in human bodies. For instance, the cedar blossom that came out in the spring this year. Wait a minute, where are we? Last year in Japan was very, very concentrated with cesium. And, of course, the blossom and the pollen, you know, is dispensed by the winds all over the place. That's just one example. Now, the fish being caught off the coast near Fukushima, many of them are showing very high radiation levels. 63% of the fish, I think, caught within 20 kilometres or 20 miles of Fukushima had very high levels of cesium. They're only measuring cesium. Mind you, there are several hundred radioactive elements that are released during a reactor accident. Some last seconds and some last millions of years. Now, I know that Japanese food is being imported into America. I know that Hillary Clinton signed an agreement with the Japanese government soon after the accident that there would be no inhibitions or restrictions on importing Japanese food into America. So I would advise everyone, because you don't know what food's radioactive and what is not, because you can't taste it or smell it or see it, not to eat Japanese food. Be very, very careful. And I know Japanese food is very popular now. Mm-hmm. Green tea and seaweed and sushi and the like. I went to a sushi restaurant in New York, a very sort of high-flying place recently, and I said to them, where does the fish come from? And they said, oh, Japan. And I really couldn't believe it. So you have to educate yourselves and be very, very cautious. Now, one of the papers being, so we're going to talk about radiation levels in America and what the EPA is doing to monitor the air and the water and the food and the fish and what they're not doing. We have a paper being presented to show that babies being born after Fukushima in California have a higher than normal incidence of hypothyroidism. In other words, their thyroids were probably impacted by radioactive iodine getting into the mother and through the umbilical cord into the baby, which then concentrated in their thyroids and caused the thyroids not to be hypoactive, not produce enough thyroid hormone, which is, that's grim. So that's being presented. We're mostly going to be concentrating on what's happening in Japan and also around Chernobyl. A very important report was produced by the New York Academy of Sciences in 2009, documenting 5,000 Russian peer-reviewed articles that were written in Russian and finally translated. And it seems that probably by now over a million people have probably died from Chernobyl, and that's only the first 25 years. And I remind people that these elements remain radioactive for hundreds of years. In fact, 40% of Europe now is contaminated with radioactive fallout from Chernobyl, and so much of the European food is carrying radioactive elements. I carefully do not eat any European food or drink European wine if I could possibly avoid it.
Wow. I mean, this is, you know, this is a whole world of concern that most people are really entirely ignorant of.
Yes.
I mean, one of the things that I've noticed, and this is both since the Deepwater Horizon incident, which, you know, resulted in massive contamination with toxic chemicals of the aquatic wildlife and food and the water of the Gulf of Mexico, and then the Fukushima incident, is that these things happen, everyone's upset. But, you know, the fact that each one of these incidents is a major hit to the food supply is something that people kind of gloss over. I mean, I personally don't eat much fish nowadays and haven't for several years, even though I love it. You know, because of these factors, it just seems like, you know, we don't, even though Michael Pollan has enjoined people to know where their food is coming from, you know, the usual response is, oh, well, it's from the farmer's market. You know, it's kind of like if it shows up in the store, it must be okay.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the thing is, nuclear accidents never end because the pollution they produce of the ground and the trees and the food supply, it just goes on for hundreds of years. But more than that, not only will they increase the incidence of cancer for hundreds of years through future generations, but the radiation damages the genes in the eggs and sperm, and that produces genetic disease through the generations, which are handed down generation to generation. There are over 2,000 genetic diseases now described in the medical literature, causing mental retardation, dwarfism, cystic fibrosis, diabetes. I could go on and on and on. And so what even if there are no accidents, the radioactive waste that has accrued in America, 64,000 tons just civilian waste, let alone the military waste, which is about equal to that, the EPA says it must be stored for 1 million years, isolated from the ecosphere. A, that's impossible. B, no container lasts for over 100 years. C, this stuff is going to be leaking for the rest of time and concentrating in the food supplies for the rest of time. And what people do not understand is that it's damaging the very building blocks of life, which are the genes. And so we're going to produce, if we survive global warming or possible nuclear war, it's going to produce, you know, degradation of the human species, but all other species have genes too. So we're damaging the positive processes of evolution in a very rapid way. And the nuclear industry don't understand that. General people don't understand that. We physicians do, because we learn about genetics in our medical courses. The best audiences I ever address are doctors when they have their weekly meetings in hospitals, and I talk to maybe 100 or 200 of them, and they're devastated because we understand all of this. We don't learn the nuclear fuel cycle in medical school, but we understand the dynamics and radiation biology, and we don't get out and teach it to the general public, and the only way you can teach the general public is through the media.
Mm-hmm.
And as President Jefferson said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. This democracy is not informed, and thus the nuclear industry gets away with its evil.
Mm-hmm. I also feel, Dr. Caldicott, even among physicians, because I have worked with physicians closely for the last 25 years, and especially in the integrative health community, as well as some scientists and conventional physicians. But, you know, I was recently at a health conference this last weekend, and we've had some positive progress on our efforts to protect New York's food and water supply through maintaining a moratorium on fracking until a health impact assessment can be done, a full and complete one. And that concern has gained momentum. But at a health conference in New York City among New York doctors over the last weekend, I reported the new sort of shift in the wind after 4 years of fighting this, which compared with how long you've been raising awareness is nothing, but it's been a very full-time preoccupation for many people. And one doctor said to me, well, I'm really glad that your cause, that you're having success with your cause. You know, I'm a person who adopted a cause, but so there is a disconnect. You know, there's a preaching about eating healthy. There's concern for health, but doctors, they tend to focus on individual patients, and they haven't, in many cases, I wish, you have, and a few others have, but they tend not to go out on the stump and step beyond treating a patient to address major public health concerns.
Well, when patients present with cancer, rarely do we take an occupational history. Mm-hmm. Rarely do we ask where they lived. I mean, did they live near Rocky Flats or a nuclear reactor? You know, recent studies have shown that children under the age of 5 living less than 5 kilometres from a reactor or 2 miles have a higher than normal incidence of leukemia and solid cancers. Mm-hmm. And they did that study in Germany and France. So people are at risk living near reactors. So are pregnant women. Their fetuses are at risk. Children are very sensitive to radiation. That will be discussed at the symposium, as are fetuses. And women are twice as sensitive as men. This is not talked about generally yet. Preventive medicine is published through the political process. How did we eliminate smallpox from the world? Well, we educated the politicians about smallpox. We got the money allocated to immunize the global population against smallpox, and it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly with polio, similarly with all sorts of other diseases. There's an apocryphal story about a water pump in London that was spewing out cholera vibrio, and there was a cholera epidemic in London, and it took the doctors 6 months to convince the politicians to turn off the pump. When the pump was turned off, the cholera stopped. So we tend not to be aware of environmental factors. It took smoking, it took us decades to get people to understand that smoking caused cancer. On the other hand, the tobacco company spent millions and millions injecting doubt into the population, saying, well, we're not sure that smoking causes cancer. Now everyone accepts it. Well, it's the same with nuclear power. We're not sure if radiation really causes cancer, they say. So it really is a process of educating doctors to then educate the public and look at all aspects of preventive medicine. And so I say I practice now global preventive medicine, which I do.
You certainly do. Let's take a break here for station identification, and we'll come back and talk about this more, because I'd like to ask you a little bit. I mean, turning off that one, kind of thing that was excreting cholera, but as you point out, this is more of a parallel with the smoking situation, because there's a large industry. So when we come back, I'd like to talk more a little bit about that. So stay with us, listeners, on Connect the Dots for the second half of the show. I'm Allison Rose Levy, speaking today with Dr. Helen Caldicott. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Today, we're talking about the medical and ecological consequences of the Fukushima nuclear accident with Dr. Helen Caldicott. Dr. Caldicott, in the first half of the show, we talked about a whole range of really fascinating information. And listeners, if you're just tuning in now, please go to the Connect the Dots archives and listen to the full show. It's really packed with information that really doesn't get out there as often as I would like to see, and I think as we all need to see. One of the things that you said was in the first half of the show was that when physicians organize and educate the public, some of these things can be changed. But you also cited the struggle against the tobacco industry for public recognition and response to its health impacts. What is the role played by the nuclear industry in all of this? And is public policy in the United States in a place where people are really cognizant of radiation and its impacts, and where it's regulated in a manner that's truly protective of the public, in your opinion?
Well, it goes way back to the Manhattan Project. It was decided by the Pentagon in 1956 that it would be a good idea to harness atoms for peace. In other words, to use the fissioning power of the atom to produce electricity. Mm-hmm. And it was decided, and I have a lovely quote in one of my books, I think, by a psychologist at the Pentagon, that would calm people's anxiety about nuclear weapons if we sort of said, look, here's a nice aspect of nuclear power. It's not necessarily bombs. It's all peaceful and calm and fine. So that's why they set it up. So the two are intermingled. Nuclear power is like a Trojan horse, if you will, for the nuclear weapons industry. They're both extraordinarily powerful. You know how powerful the Pentagon is, and the nuclear labs, and the Department of Energy, which makes all the bombs, let me tell you, and puts them in their shelters and transports them around the country in Winnebagos and the like. Very, very scary. Most of the money the Department of Energy spends is on nuclear weapons and nuclear power. Very little of it is spent on solar, and the whole of America should be solarized. There should be electric cars powered by solar energy, and there should be wind farms right across America. But they're not investing in that. So the power of the nuclear industry is inordinate, and they give money, as you know. I mean, let's face it, all the politicians in this country are corporate prostitutes. Mm-hmm. They get money to get elected, and then they represent the corporations who gave them the money, and they don't, you know, represent the people. A, most of them are medically and scientifically illiterate, and B, they're beholden to the people that gave them the money. So this system stinks, let's be frank. It stinks. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
The politicians are elected by the people, but the people are ignorant, the politicians are ignorant, and the whole thing is run on money. And how can you possibly protect the health of the people when the nuclear industry is so inordinately powerful? Obama, who I think is a good man underneath, doesn't understand the medical aspects of nuclear power. I mean, I just like half an hour with the man. He's got two daughters who he adores. And as a pediatrician, I could educate him about the medical dangers of nuclear power. I tell you what, though, if there's a meltdown in America like Fukushima, that's the end of the nuclear industry. That's it. But it's a terrible thing to have to say that it's not unless Americans see the dreadful, dreadful catastrophe that would result from a nuclear meltdown, will they do anything about it? You know, will the Japanese, well, that's too bad, and it's probably getting better, which it's not, it's getting worse. Or the Russians. I mean, I remember when I was on ABC radio just after Chernobyl, and the man said to me, well, they're only Russians. And I said, what? I said, I'm a physician. All human beings are precious and equal. It was an extraordinary situation. So we have to value life, all life. Mm-hmm. And on that note, I will say we've got a wonderful evolutionary biologist called Tim Mousseau, who's been going into the exclusion zones at risk to his own life and health, where the radiation is extremely high around Chernobyl and Fukushima. And he's been looking at the birds and the butterflies and the bees and the other insects and plants and looking at what's happening. Well, the birds I've been examining, the swallows, they have smaller than normal brains. Many of the male swallows are sterile. There's a decrease in the number of species and the number within each species. The birds have mutations to produce crooked wings or aberrant tail feathers, and it's the same with the insects. And he's finding this both in Fukushima and Chernobyl. Now, in medicine, we always experiment on patients with various drugs, and not patients, animals, with various drugs to find out if they're toxic to animals, and then we extrapolate that data to humans, whether or not the drug is safe. Well, so what is happening to the animals and the birds and the insects there will happen to the human beings. This work is so extremely important. I think this man will probably be eligible for a Nobel Prize. I'm sure of that. The work he's doing is extraordinary, and people need to know about this. Because people are writing articles saying, oh, well, the wildlife's come back around Chernobyl. Yeah, some bears are coming back and the horses are coming back because there are no humans to get rid of them. But and they come and go, but what no one's looking at is the mutations within these species and the aberrations that are being developed, and that's what will happen to us.
Yeah, because that's the whole thing. It's kind of like, you know, the reach of the technologies that we have developed over the last century in our time has an extraordinary, broad-ranging, far-reaching, in many cases, global impact. But our, you know, humanity and human concern hasn't kept pace, so that, you know, there's still kind of this, very local, maybe, you know, humankind has been bred for a very local, or, you know, was developed in a very tribal and local manner, so that, you know, the realm of concern is only immediate and local. That seems to be all that many people can handle. Some are looking beyond to larger communities and to the earth itself and all peoples, as you state. But in fact, you know, a lot of people are just, if it hasn't happened to me or in, you know, my, or even sometimes what happens in the neighborhood isn't even of concern. If it doesn't come into my family, and you know, then it doesn't exist, and they don't see that there's a chain of reaction, as you mentioned, all the way from the animals.
You're partly right about that, but partly wrong, because I don't know if you remember the 80s or how old you were then, but I organized Physicians for Social Responsibility, and we recruited 23,000 doctors. And we got ourselves on television and the media talking about the medical effects of nuclear war. Now, it's true that it was scary because we had Reagan, and he was talking about pressing the button, and he hated the Russians, and the Americans hated the Russians, and all that absolute nonsense and rubbish. Mm-hmm. And people were scared that a nuclear war could occur between Russia and America. So we got out, although many people said to me at the time, well, I'd rather be dead than red. And I said, what, you'd rather be? Yeah, we don't want to be communists. I mean, it was really an extraordinary situation, psychotic almost. So we got out to explain and describe the medical effects of nuclear war. And in fact, in 5 years, 80% of the Americans became opposed, ardently opposed to nuclear weapons. And we got 1 million people in Central Park, the biggest demonstration in the history of that city, mm-hmm. or the country, I think. And it helped, and I met Reagan and in the White House, and he didn't know much, and I think I taught him a bit, and he started then working with Gorbachev, and that brought an end to the Cold War. Now, nuclear war was kind of a distant thing. It didn't necessarily involve people, but it might have. If a bomb dropped on your city, it would have vaporized you, and it still could because the weapons are still in place, ready to be launched. Nothing's changed since that time, and we could have a nuclear war tonight by computer error or the like, or someone hacking into the system in the Pentagon. But we were able to teach people some sort of distant reality mm-hmm. by just educating them, and it was... Mm-hmm. We really covered the media in an extraordinary way. And I was on 60 Minutes and Good Morning America and all the rest. Mm-hmm. So once again, I'll come back to the fact that, and as a physician, I know this, you have to educate the patients about their disease and what, you know, what drugs they have to take and how uncomfortable they'll be to help them get through something very unpleasant. Well, it's the same with the general population. We have to teach the people, again, about the dangers of the nuclear age, both nuclear power, and if there's a meltdown, and there will be in America, probably sooner than later, and there are 104 reactors in this country, now 103, I think, they closed one down, any of which could go off at any time, and with global warming occurring, you know, the oceans are rising, many reactors are built on the coast, their control rooms could be flooded, there could be tsunamis and the like. A lot of them are on rivers, and with the droughts, the rivers are drying up or getting too hot to cool the reactors. They need 1 million gallons a minute of cooling water going through their systems. Hurricanes can knock out the electricity supply, like the earthquake did in Fukushima. If you lose your electricity supply to a reactor, you lose the cooling water because the pumps go out. Then you could have a meltdown. There was that flood, I can't remember the name of the reactor, in the Midwest, which damaged that reactor enormously. Mm-hmm. So there's a great risk, and people need to wake up, and they need to close these damn things down. The trouble is the law is always written to protect the corporations. That's true, but law should be written to protect the majority of the people. Laws are not written in stone, and we can change the laws. So that's what you must do.
So what you're describing actually is, I mean, this is an epoch where the synergies that you describe, you know, all of the synergies that could come about as a result of the changes in weather actually make reactors that were obviously risky to begin with even more dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in New York, we had a power outage. We had floods. We had, I mean, and, you know,
there were a lot of reactors on the East Coast at risk from that Hurricane Sandy.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Is that being talked about?
They closed them down. They shut off their fissioning reaction, but they still could have been damaged because they're still terribly, terribly hot and must be cooled continuously. Pilgrim was in trouble. I'm going to testify at a trial of some protesters at Pilgrim at the entrance of Cape Cod. Of course, mm-hmm. if that reactor melted, no one would get off Cape Cod. Very mm-hmm. wealthy people live in Cape Cod, and some of them, you know, you'd think they'd rise up and close the damn thing down. It's 40 years old. It's the same design as the Fukushima reactors. It's got a huge amount of radioactive fuel stored there. I can't remember how much. 10 times more than what's released at Chernobyl, I think. And the cooling pools, I mean, people are at terrible risk. And so I'm going to testify for these protesters who want to shut the thing down. It's medically indicated. It's like telling a patient they have to stop smoking or they'll probably get cancer or emphysema or you know, gangrene of the legs or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting, in Australia we now have cigarette packets that are plain. They're covered with sort of olive green paper, ugly stuff. Mm-hmm. There's no trademarks or signs of who make the things. And there are pictures of people dying of cancer or babies, deformed babies or the like, on the front of the cigarette packets.
Mm-hmm.
They are put behind closed doors, so you have to ask for them. I think it now costs about $20 for a packet of 20 cigarettes. And we were the first country, actually, in the world to do that to cigarette packaging. Now, that's, you know, we really kind of need to put those sort of images on the cooling towers of the reactors, you know, people dying of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Or bald-headed children being treated for their leukemia or whatever.
So people, you know, because so people see the connection, because otherwise they'll just
or
think
billboards
it happened out
along
of
the roads, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's medically indicated for people to understand and to start taking notice.
How long does it take? So, for example, right now, as we're recording this, there's a storm coming to my region. So, you know, how long does it take from the moment that, you know, for somebody at a nuclear reactor to decide, oh, this is going to be a bad one, we better kind of turn this one down? And, you know, what does that mean? In other words, if there's a power outage, you know, if they decided 6 hours before, could they turn it down and make it safe?
Well, they don't turn it down. They drop the control rods down between the nuclear fuel bundles and stop the fission reaction.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's very stinking hot, the fuel, extremely hot because of all the fission products that are created during the fission reaction, strontium and cesium, and I could go on and on, several hundred. And so if you lose your power, they have diesel reactors diesel generators at the reactors. They often, when they try to start them, they don't work. They don't start them often enough and test them. But so I think they have two diesel generators. They're about as big as a house at each reactor.
Mm-hmm.
So the diesel generators, when started, they last for 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
If they have enough fuel, they can keep them running. But so you lose your pumps, so then you turn on your generators to keep the pumps running. But if that doesn't work, within about an hour, without cooling, the fuel starts to melt.
That's shocking.
It is. And in my book, Nuclear Power's Not the Answer, I describe a meltdown and the various stages. They've all been given names by the nuclear engineers. And I describe a meltdown at Indian Point and what would happen. And people should know that the fellows who flew into the World Trade Towers, in fact, had targeted the two Indian Point reactors. If they'd gone into them, New York would not exist now.
Mm-hmm. That's shocking.
You wouldn't have just lost 3,000 people. You would have lost millions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they were sort of somehow got
well,
redirected.
Well, the reason they didn't go in was they thought they were protected by missiles, but of course they're not. There's no protection against planes flying into them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you want to destroy the financial capital of the world, you just fly into the Indian Point reactors.
What you're pointing to is tremendous vulnerability. Vulnerability of
absolutely
health.
Absolutely correct.
Vulnerability of life. And yet we're tooling along as if we're somehow protected.
Practicing psychic numbing and denial.
Mm-hmm.
And manic denial. You know, all this sort of emphasis on food and fashions and clothes when the Earth is in such danger. And I'm not just talking about nuclear power now. Global warming is a factor, and it's just happening so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And the permafrost is melting in the Arctic Circle, will be releasing millions of tons of carbon dioxide and methane. That's a tipping point. And a tipping point means if you've got a patient in the ICU and you think they're pretty well controlled, they're very, very sick, and then say they get an infection,
mm-hmm.
and the infection tips them over into a situation where then their cardiac function fails and their liver starts failing and they reach what's called total organ collapse. The tipping point was the infection. The tipping point to the survival of life systems on the planet is the melting of the permafrost. Mm-hmm. And I've interviewed one of the world's experts on that on my radio program, and he was, you know, a very upright scientist, very good. And I said to him, look, in medicine, we always extrapolate to the worst case scenario for a patient and work to prevent that, that we have to do. And I said, I want you to tell us what the worst case scenario would be. And he could hardly talk. He could hardly talk. And he said, well, it's going to be a catastrophe. And it's happening as I speak.
Mm-hmm.
And still, you're pumping out CO. I mean, I'm sitting here in Seattle watching cars up and down the freeway pumping out CO2. A huge crane organized by electricity. Now, I think much of the electricity from Seattle comes from hydro, but most of the electricity in America comes from coal.
Mm-hmm.
Nuclear provides 20%. And yet, there's no evidence the politicians understand. Obama doesn't understand. They're probably going to have that Keystone pipeline open from the tar sands in Canada. You know, we're just blindly, like lemmings, rushing towards the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's always the aspect that we could have a nuclear war tonight. Now, that's not on any front pages at all, but people are writing about it.
I think there's a sense, even among people, because when I go out and about, which I do a great deal, and talk to people about climate change, global warming, and all of these issues, there's a sense that people have that we're talking about 500 years, 250 years. There's, you know, it's kind of like, yes, there are some people who just outright deny it because they've been reached by the disinformation campaigns paid for by billionaires. But there are many others who acknowledge it's a problem, but yet life continues as usual because they assume that it's, you know, several hundred years off.
That's because they're not educated.
What's your sense of that in terms of time frame?
In Australia, we've had the most ghastly bushfires, just mm-hmm. ghastly. We had a day the other day where I lived, south of Sydney, where it was 45 degrees centigrade. What would that be? Nearly 120. I didn't think I was going to survive. I just had to take all my clothes off, lie on the floor naked, and be covered with a wet towel. It was just extraordinary. And I'm older, you know, I'm nearly 75. People can't survive at that temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And these days are becoming more and more common. And then, to top it all, as well as losing houses and lives and everything in these ghastly bushfires that go at 100 miles an hour across the country, we're having huge, huge, disastrous floods. And global warming was predicted to do both of those, fires and floods. I wrote about it in 91 in my book, If You Love This Planet. It was all predicted by the mm-hmm. scientists, and it's all coming to pass. It's happening much faster than any of us realize. And I look at my grandchildren, who I adore. They have no future, these children.
I hear of people in, coming young adults and all of that who, you know, those who are aware are really feeling concerned to even bring in the next generation.
A lot of them are deciding not to have babies.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in 63 when I had my first baby, mm-hmm. thinking to myself, should I bring a child into this world?
Mm-hmm.
Then I fell so much in love with him, I had three in 3 years because I became addicted, but... and now he's nearly 50 and he's got mm-hmm. two children of his own, but he's as aware as I am about what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, the only way it can be fixed is by educating the politicians, and I think most people here don't understand what a democracy means. It means that you own the politicians, you are their leaders, and they are your servants and representatives, and you have to get to know them every time they come back to the district and go and educate them and say, if you don't do this, this, and this, I'm going to make sure you don't get elected next time. And door knock and go and see them in Washington. Washington's full of lobbyists run by the corporations. I mean, really evil types, let's be frank. And then there's a revolving door. They come out of Congress and they go straight into corporations like Boeing, who makes nuclear weapons and nuclear missiles. I mean, it's a, or Lockheed Martin that's setting the world up to be, you know, blown up in half an hour by nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're setting up war in space. They're building weapons to put in space, to fight war in space. And affect very many kills, they say. People don't know about that, but you're paying us for it with your tax dollars. Meanwhile, you don't have a free healthcare system. You have
right.
socialized killing, which is the Pentagon, $1 trillion a year, but you have capitalistic medical care, which means most people can't afford it. In Australia, it's free.
Mm-hmm.
Free. You know, you break your kneecap, you go to hospital, you have the best orthopedic surgeon in Sydney, an anaesthetic, you stay in for 5 days. You know how much it was? Nothing.
Mm.
That's how tax dollars should be spent. Oh, but it might be socialism. Oh, what a naughty word. But Jesus was a socialist. I mean, it's so silly.
Mm.
It means generosity and kindness. Society should be set up to care for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
There should be no homeless people in the streets in the richest country on earth.
Mm-hmm.
Reagan emptied out all the mental hospitals, and there are schizophrenics who need treatment and bathing and caring and being fed in their hospitals, you know,
mm-hmm.
and alcoholics who need treatment.
Mm-hmm.
We can't be cruel.
It's cruel, and also because of the cruelty of the society and the struggle that people have here, I think there are more people that have, and also because of all the toxic contaminants, radioactivity, chemicals, and all the rest, there are, you know, people are getting sicker and sicker. I think there are rising rates of most cancers and all kinds of health problems.
That's true, except you have to know that you've got a lousy healthcare system, and I think your mortality rate's about 24th in the world. You should have, you know, people should live longer, but the truth is most people here do live a long time compared to the developing world, where people are still getting leprosy and polio, and babies are dying of cholera and salmonella and dysentery and the like because of dirty water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to extend our horizons. This country needs to fix itself up urgently, but the horizons need to be extended to the whole world. And I think particularly we need to think about overpopulation. You know, 200 years ago, there were 1 billion human beings. There are now 7 billion.
Mm-hmm.
That means exponential growth. I mean, we're not going to survive. We're outbreeding ourselves under death. And the way you stop overpopulation is you educate women and you provide them with birth control. And they stop breeding, because their children will live, they don't need lots of kids, and they know how to stop it. Now, that could easily be done through the United Nations if this country decided to fund it, and it could, instead of spending $1 trillion on weapons to kill people all over the world.
You're right. We have a very distorted ecology, to put it mildly. We're coming down to the last minutes of our program here, and I just want to provide the opportunity to give listeners an opportunity to follow up with more of your, you know, your thought and your communications and all that you're doing. They can do that by going to nuclearfreeplanet.org. Where else do you like to send people to take action and stay informed?
Oh, well, if you go to my personal web page, helencaldicott.com, all the books I've written are there, and you can order them from Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I like Amazon too much, but you can.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm about to start writing another book called Why Men Kill and Why Women Let Them, because unless we analyze why we're so psychotic that killing's okay, we're going to blow ourselves up and destroy ourselves, that's for sure. And I think it's time that we made the diagnosis about the aberration in the human brain, but particularly the testosterone-fueled brain, about how this is happening and why we glorify war and killing, you know, in society. What is it all about?
Mm-hmm.
And also the women must be empowered, and we're not really. We're not. You know, we stand back and we're not even receiving equal pay, let alone 53% of us are women. We have
mm-hmm.
all the babies. We have the nurturing hormones. And yet we're wimps. And it's time we you know, step forward and say, okay, you blokes, you've had enough. We need to smack your bottoms. Now we're taking over. The men quite like that, actually.
Well, thank you so much, Helen Caldicott. That can't be topped. Good luck with everything you're doing. We'll be reporting more on your activities.
Okay.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us today with Helen Caldicott.
Thank you.
On Connect the Dots. Tune in next week at 10 a.m. Eastern Time every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network.